KOYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 151 of Sign Language. I've got a couple of emails to cover, and then I'll get into the discussion that I wanted to have about compression. The first email was from Rob Bettler, and Rob said,
"Hoi, dear sensei of audio lands. First of all, I just listened to the latest podcast, and thank you for making the time despite the fact you are so busy. It is exactly because of that I haven't sent any ramblings as of late, simply because I said, all right, he's going to be really busy with the project, so I'd better not bother him. And who would have thought you would have had time thanks to orchestral complications?" Wow. How many people can say that? Orchestral complications. "I, however, do have something to mention regarding Chad's taste for dynamics. So between you and me, it appears what he called lifeless was actually a side effect of the loudness wars. It would not surprise me if he's another veteran with a penchant for forbid tube dynamics." Is that how you spell it, forbid tube? Am I right or really off on my assessment of his tubeness? So where are you standing? Are you still in a lull or have things resumed? Has Chad managed to wrangle the orchestra members or are they still on the loose? Regards, Rob the Guapo Bettler.
Now, the reason for my mirth, Rob, is because I don't know if you're taking the piss or if you were serious about forbid tube. this is, if anyone else has not quite picked up on this, Rob is referring to my common description of heavily peak limited audio as forbid two, meaning a block of wood, 4 inches by 2 inches, right? Which is commonly referred to as a piece of forbid two, right? Now, I don't know if Rob's just deliberately misconstruing that or if he really misheard me and thought I said forbid tube and he was not sure what that actually meant. So if that's what you were thinking, Rob, no, I was referring to the waveform of a heavily peak limited piece of audio looking like a piece of forbid two timber because it's just rectangular. That gave me a good chuckle. So where are we at the moment? Well, I sent Chad a stereo mix about almost 2 weeks ago now, and he wrote back to me sort of within 24 hours, and he said, "Mate, thank you for the new mix." He said, "I really desperately want to get to have a listen to it." He said, "But this coming week is absolutely chock-a-block with work commitments," and he said, "and then on the weekend I've got my mum flying in from out of town, she'll be here for a few days, and then once she goes things will return to normal." So that sort of brought us through to around about Tuesday of this week my time, at which point he came back to me and he said, "Mate, it sounds amazing, there's just a couple of little things here and there." But one of the things that he did raise was, he said, the narration track that you're using, he said, "is that the original unprocessed audio or is it the processed version of the audio that Jake did when Jake did some of the sound design stuff for, you know, like the demon and the explosions and whatnot?" And I wrote back to him and I said, "No, that's the processed version that Jake, you know, had baked certain effects into." And I said, "Look, you know, if you want me to work off the raw stuff, I'd be happy to do that because, you know, I'd probably, you know, process the voice track a little differently." So what he did was he said, "Well, look, don't worry about trying to, you know, go scrounging back through all of that original material that I sent, you know, 3 months ago." He said, "I'll just export you a new OMF of just the narration." And he said, "and you can then use that for processing." So I went, "Okay, no worries." So sure enough, within, you know, 6 hours or so, he uploaded a new OMF to Google Drive for me, which I downloaded. And what was really interesting about this was that when I opened up that OMF, everything was exactly as I expected it would be. You know, the narration was laid out, and there were a couple of other sync dialogue pieces from camera. And what was most interesting was the very last line of the narration, which right throughout this whole process, we've been having an issue with. Every mix I've sent to Chad, he's gone, oh, mate, this is great, that's awesome. He said, but that last line, something, it just doesn't sound right. And I had been thinking much the same thing. It just sounded like it had been mic'd badly or something. And I couldn't put my finger on it. Now, remember, I was working off a rendered voice track, not the original source files, right? So when I got this OMF this week from Chad and I've opened it up, I'm sort of zooming in and I'm scrolling through and I'm listening and I'm, you know, rearranging where things were, you know, getting all of the narration parts onto one track so that I could then, you know, apply whatever processing I was going to apply, which in this case was a healthy dose of Isotopes RX3 noise reduction. But I get right down to the end of the project and I come to this very last line of the narration. Which is, all of the narration is done by Chad's daughter, Natty, who's, she must be about 10 now, I guess. And I find there are two instances of the line, of this line of narration, on two tracks. And I've gone, oh, that's weird. So what I did was I listened to them in mono, as because the OMF came through with no pan information. It was just everything was in the center. Played across this, these two instances of this voice, and, it still had this horrible sound to it. And then I muted one track, and suddenly it sounded fantastic. And I've gone, whoa, what's going on there? And so then I muted that track and then unmuted the other one and had a listen to that one, and it sounded fine. And I'm thinking, oh, hang on, something's not right here. So I've panned the tracks hard left and hard right, unmuted the track that was then muted, played across it, and it was obvious straight away there was a phase issue, or more correctly, a polarity issue. And I've zoomed in, and you could see it. You could see that, on one voice track where the waveform was going into positive territory, north of the center line, on the next track down from the other mic source, the waveform was in negative territory and they were cancelling each other out. And I was like, oh my God, this has obviously been the problem all along. Somehow, I don't know whether it was Jake or whether it was, I don't think it was me inadvertently, those two tracks got merged together into the mono version of the narration track that I'd been working off for the last 3 months with this, polarity issue. And so that was causing all this weird phasiness I guess I should have picked up on that earlier because I'd never seen a split track version of that narration track. It didn't occur to me that it might have been, a phase issue that had been summed to mono and was cancelling itself out. So it was really nice to get to the bottom of that. And so I wrote Chad an email. I went, oh man, you won't believe what I just discovered, And so he was absolutely ecstatic when, he wrote back to me and went, oh man, that is such good news. Even though he hasn't heard it yet, without the phase issue, he's pretty excited that we at least got to the bottom of it and worked out why, that one line of narration has been giving us grief all along. Because to me, every time I heard it, I just kept thinking, they must have used a different mic on this, because it had that kind of ringiness that you get from a really cheap, nasty microphone. And so I was thinking, okay, maybe this was shot on a different day and the location recorders had a different microphone on or something like that. So it was really good to get to the bottom of that. So to get back to your question, Rob, where are we at? I've now processed this new OMF of all of the narration track. I have not applied any EQ. I'll think about that when I come to incorporating this new rendered narration track into the final mix. I'll then decide whether or not it needs any EQ to help it cut through the mix. And there's just a couple of other little level issues here and there that Chad wants to tweak. But beyond that, we're pretty darn close to signing off on the stereo mix. As for your comments regarding, you know, Chad's description of the first mix being lifeless, you know, being related to the loudness wars, I don't agree with that, simply because that initial mix that I sent to him had almost no compression on it at all, because I thought we were going for a really dynamic kind of mix. I thought that was where he wanted it to be. And the thing that, you know, compression can just tighten everything up, bring it all together in a way that, you know, without compression, it just has a completely different vibe. And even though the relative levels between certain things can still be correct without compression, they just, it's a totally different sound. I guess whether if you've ever mucked around with, you know, multiple sound sources and building a mix without any compression, and you get it to sound nice without any compression, and then you can add some compression to it, and it just kind of glues it all together in such a beautiful way. You know, as long as you got the right compressor and, you know, the right settings for it. Yeah, so I think what Chad was, you know, getting at when he said that that original mix sounded lifeless was just the fact that there wasn't any compression sort of, you know, just crushing it all together. And I guess that was just a communication error on my part, you know, in that I had misinterpreted what he wanted from the final mix. You know, and once we kicked the ball around a little bit and I sort of started to realize that what he wanted was that, you know, much more compressed in your face kind of sound, then it was easy for me to go, oh, okay, now I know what you want. And we started going down that route, and he was like, yeah, this is epic. So we'll get there. So we're pretty close to the end in terms of a stereo mix. And then, you know, Chad has basically said, you know, once we get the stereo mix, you do the 5.1 and I'll trust your judgment on it. So, and I think this has probably been a good thing, because in approaching the stereo mix first, knowing that Chad's able to listen to it on a decent system and have a very good understanding of how that mix is sounding, means that once he signs off on the stereo mix, the adaptation of that into a 5.1 mix won't mess with all of the hard work we've done in getting that stereo mix to where it needs to be, because it'll just be a case of, you know, putting some music and some of the ambiences into the surround channels, and that's pretty much it, you know, because as I've said in the previous episode, all the on-screen dialogue, the narration, all your sound effects, they're all going to occupy front left, front right, and center. And obviously, you know, occasional bits of LFE. So, yeah, it'll really just be musical score, reverbs, and ambiences going to the surround channel. So, yeah, so once we sign off on the stereo mix, the 5.1 should be pretty easy. So, yeah, so that's where I'm at with the project. However, we shall now move on to a big email I got from Greg Anderson in Utah. Haven't heard from Greg for a while, and he actually put in the subject line of his email, "Still listening, even if I don't talk much."
Bruce, I'm listening with great interest to your tales of working on a 5.1 sound design project for Chad's short movie, but you're leaving out heaps of details that I'd like to know. For example, just how difficult is it to set up a 5.1 channel monitoring system?
Okay, I'm gonna break into this, because there's a fair few bits that I'll want to interject on this email, so I'll just pop in and out as we get to the questions. How difficult was it to set up the 5.1? It took a little while, simply because I'm the kind of guy that loves to do it myself. I'm DIY if I can, you know, and in this particular instance, that meant making up all of the balanced XLR cables to run from the output of my sound card to the input of my subwoofer. So I spent probably a week just soldering cables. The outputs from my sound card, however, are not XLR. The 8 analog inputs on this particular sound card, which, as I've mentioned in the past, is a M-Audio Fast-Track Ultra 8R, the inputs are all Nutrik connectors, which, if you're familiar with them, are basically a combination of both an XLR input and a tip ring and sleeve input. So you can have a cable which either has an XLR connector or has a tip ring and sleeve connector, and it can go into these sockets on the back of the unit. It's a very clever design, the Nutrik connector, because, you know, it gives you that flexibility, you know, regardless of what cable you've got. As long as it's balanced, it doesn't matter whether it's got an XLR connector or a tip ring and sleeve connector. However, while the input side has Nutrik connectors, the outputs, the eight analog outputs, are tip ring and sleeve only. So whatever output cables you're going to use, they have to be terminated with tip ring and sleeve at this end, you know, at the end that connects to the sound card. They've got to be tip ring and sleeve. They can't be XLR. So I can understand the design methodology there, you know, or the, you know, the thinking behind it, because on the input side, you quite often will just want to bring in a microphone signal, right? So you can plug a mic cable into the back, because the Fasttrak Ultra 8R has eight mic pre's built into it. So you could, you know, run eight microphone cables into those input sockets, use the mic pre's that are in the unit, and you don't need a desk, right? You've basically just gone straight from eight condenser mics straight into your sound card. But on the input, on the output side, it's all tip ring and sleeve. So what I had to do, and I think I mentioned this before, my subwoofer is a Genelec sub, so it's a professional studio grade subwoofer, and it has input connectors for all six channels as female XLRs, and five output connectors, which are all male XLR, to then feed your five full frequency channels, you know, left front, right front, center, left surround, rear surround. So what I had to do was basically solder the cables to run from, because in the past, before I attempted to, you know, get involved in this 5.1 mixing caper, the signal flow out of my Fasttrak Ultra 8R was outputs 1 and 2 on tip ring and sleeve to the input of just a cheap Behringer 2004 mixer, which is sitting on the desk beside me. And the inputs on that, I think they're tip ring and sleeve from memory. There's multiple inputs I'm looking at as I'm recording. There are inputs that come in on TRS, and I think there are also some inputs on the back that go in on XLR, and I can't remember which ones were coming from the sound card. But anyway, either way, it was a balanced signal from the output of the sound card to the input of this Behringer desk, and then the output, the control room output from the Behringer desk, again, balanced out, went to the first two inputs on the sub. So, or sorry, not the first two, one and three, because the input connectors on the subwoofer are laid out in your typical SMPTE 5.1 configuration. So left front, center, right front, then left surround, right surround. The LFE is actually separate. So yeah, I was right the first time. The outputs from the Behringer mixer went out and into inputs 1 and 3 on the sub, so left front and right front, and then from the outputs of left front, right front, I had XLR connectors running to my Genelec main speakers. So what I had to do was essentially throw away all those four cables. Well, not throw them away, I've still got them, they're still in place for times when I need to revert back to a stereo setup. Like I'm doing right now, because I actually need the Behringer in the signal path to monitor my own voice as I'm recording my podcast. So I'm constantly around the back of the rack changing the one and two outputs. So with this new setup, I've got the first six analog outputs from the sound card, all tip ring and sleeve, microphone cable running to the six inputs on the sub, right? And then the five outputs from the sub, because obviously you don't need an output for the LFE because the sub is the end of the line. But the other five outputs then come out, left front and right front, obviously go straight to the inputs of the Genelec mains, which are, these 80-20s or 80-30s? I can't remember. The output to the center channel goes to an old NAD home stereo amplifier, which I used to have as my main amp when I was still running a stereo system back in the 90s. And this is a great amp. High current design, can be bridged to run as a mono block, which I haven't bothered to do because I don't need that much grunt. I'm not driving the system stupidly loud. And then that feeds the center channel. And then the outputs from left surround, right surround, out of the sub, come back to the rack, where right at the very bottom of the rack I have a big Yamaha power amp, and that power amp is driving left surround and right surround, which are a pair of Tannoy speakers. And yes, we could get into the whole argument of, oh, you should be using the same brand and the same, model of speaker, particularly for those four surround channels, the left front, right front, left surround, right surround. I don't necessarily buy into that. I think as long as all of them are good studio grade monitoring speakers, and as long as you're familiar with the sound of those speakers, then I don't really see it as a massive issue. I know there would be some purists out there who would go, nah, it's absolutely got to be four of the same speaker. Each to their own. I don't have that much money to throw around on, acquiring another pair of Genelecs, because they're about a grand each, these speakers. So, and I, wasn't going to go and spend another $2,000 to buy another couple of them when I had these Tannoys sitting around doing nothing. So, yeah, that's the long explanation of, the setup of the studio. So, back to Greg's email.
I believe you said that your computer sound card has six outputs, but until now you were only using two of them. So how much trouble is it to use all six and to properly balance all of the monitors so that you know you're listening to the mix correctly?
Good question. In the perfect world, you would use a sound pressure level meter and you would then feed pink noise into each channel separately. You don't run, the pairs together. Ideally, you would put your sound pressure level meter at the mix position, pointed at your front left speaker, crank some pink noise out through the front left speaker, and, ideally, if you're setting up for a cinematic mix, you would set the SPL meter to read 85 dB SPL. And I think that's... Why do I have a feeling you're meant to go for C-weighted, not A-weighted? I'd have to look that up. Anyway, ideally, this is what you would do. You would measure for 85 dB SPL. Once you got the output of your left front speaker reading 85 SPL, dB SPL on the meter, you would then send your pink noise only to the front right speaker, and then you would adjust the output of the right speaker until you were getting 85 dB SPL on the meter. And then you do the same for the rear left, and then you would do the same for the rear right, so that you knew that all four of them were reading 85 dB SPL at the mix position with, pink noise coming out of one speaker at a time. So that's the correct approach. I don't have a sound pressure level meter, so I fudged it. I at first did a... Just a straight listening test where I used my ears to gauge whether the sound reaching my head from both front and rear was equal in amplitude. Because I felt if it felt like it was coming more from the front than from the rear, then I figured, okay, we probably need a little more, amplification on the rear channels. So I just tweaked it that way. It's not perfect. It's not purely by the book. I recognize that. So, yeah, I'm probably not perfectly set up, but I reckon I'm pretty damn close. I had Steve Hope and his wife up here yesterday. We had a big barbie here at our place yesterday, about 30-odd people. And Steve very generously offered to assist with the encoding of the multi-channel audio when it comes time to doing that, and particularly if I needed to take a stereo mix and create a Pro Logic decodable surround version of that stereo mix. He offered to do that because he's got the software encoder to do so. So what I didn't think to mention at the time was that I might also take him up on just having him double check the 5.1 mix when I get to that point and make sure it's okay in his room. I'm pretty sure I've got my system set up right, but like I said, I haven't done it by the book like I should, but I didn't want to go spending money on this project beyond, you know, what was sensible. And because I don't know how much I'm going to get paid for this, I'm just, yeah, rolling with it. Okay, so moving on.
I have to admit that I do most of my work now with a MacBook Pro laptop computer and not strictly audio-centric. So I don't have the option of a dedicated sound card with the kind of flexibility yours offers. I suppose I need to look around for some kind of magical outboard box, which I suppose is necessary for anyone who uses that newest Mac Pro computer, the one that looks like a wastebasket. So there has to be something out there I could use. You mentioned an online community, which is offering support, encouragement, tips and tricks, etc. But I'm still very impressed at how you've managed to adapt to the concepts of movie sound design as opposed to music-oriented work. Seems like it would be a big shift to change your approach. Is it? How have you learned the right ways to approach movie sound, and how long did it take? From the way you're talking, it sounds like you have a deep and practical understanding of it all.
Well, to me, it's not that massive a shift. Remember that, you know, my day-to-day job is creating radio commercials. And as much as I hate to admit it, yeah, 90% of the stuff I produce is crap. It's horrible. Not the quality of my work, just the quality of the input. You know, you're so often working with scripts that are written by clients who have no idea of what constitutes good advertising. They just have this idea in their head of this is how everyone else advertises, this is how I should do it. And as a consequence, I think the quality of advertising just constantly gets worse and worse. The other 10% is the stuff that's really good. It's well written. You've got a client who's actually open to ideas, is prepared to listen to professionals who know what they're talking about, and will actually let you do something creative. Unfortunately, they are few and far between. But when you get something good like that, it generally has a little bit of sound design requirement. You know, there's, you know, the building of a scene in an audio only format. And I think this is what has probably allowed me to transition into doing sound design stuff for Chad's movie relatively easy. And although I've not had the conversation with Steve Hope, Steve would probably say much the same thing. When you've worked in a radio environment where it's audio only, you have to be able to paint a picture for the listener using only sound. You know, there's no visual crutch to help sell the idea, you know, or the location, or, you know, the attitude of any of what you're trying to get across. You know, you're relying on sound to tell the whole story. And so I think, you know, that probably benefits us radio guys who move into working in a visual format, because we've developed this sense, for want of a better description, of how to sell a scene using just the sound. You know, I think people who grow up in the visual medium rely on the visual side of things. And I think that's probably what has allowed a whole portion of the visual industry to pay so little regard to audio, you know, because they rely on their pictures to sell, you know, what it is they're trying to you know, get across. When you take someone who's only worked in an audio format, then you just have this natural bias to, okay, I have to get everything across using sound. And I can only put it down to that, you know, that it's that mindset that helps you transition. What was it you said? Big shift to change your approach? No, not really. Not really. As I said to Chad, you know, when I was trying to get those first mixes happening, you know, and we were having these discussions and, I started to twig to the idea that he wanted more compression. You know, I said, go and have a listen to this ad on my SoundCloud account, which I mentioned in the last episode. And, you know, sure enough, as soon as he listened to it, he went, yeah, that's what we're after, you know. And so, you know, I think those sorts of things, you know, those kinds of commercials, in particular that Etihad Airways commercial that I mentioned, you know, that's very much like movie sound design, because you're trying to paint this whole picture, but you've got no visuals. It's all done with sound. So for me, no, I didn't feel like it was a massive shift. If anything, it was an opportunity to work on, you know, in this case, a short 7.5 minute movie where the sound design is so much of it, you know, and I love doing that kind of stuff. And it's a frustration that so little of the work I do 40 hours a week involves that stuff. You know, I'm lucky if there's 10% of my work that calls on my skills to, you know, to build a, you know, a picture in the mind for the listener. And so, yeah, it's, I think that's part of what I've really enjoyed about this whole process, is just the fact that the sound design is so much more than, yeah, here's a 30-second voice track of some crap that no one cares about with a production music bed running under it, end of story. You know, that stuff's not fulfilling. What I find fulfilling is the 10% where I actually get to do something creative with the sound. That's in radio, of course. I'm not referring to Chad's project. All right, how have I learned the right ways to approach movie sound, and how long did it take? Well, like I said, to me, it's pretty much just a straight jump. Yeah, it's just throwing away the 90% of the crap work and having a gig that is just the fun part of my regular work, you know? So anyway.
Just to clarify, my own work is primarily video work with very good audio to go with it. The final mix is always two-channel stereo, except when I work for BYU Broadcasting, in which case they have their own sound guy who will create both a stereo and a 5.1 mix for all of the projects. All I do then is try to give him the best on-location audio I can and let him do the rest of the magic. But let's face it, for the past 12 years I've had software which allows me to encode 5.1 Dolby Digital audio, but I've never gone to the trouble to create the mix that can go into such an encoder. I take that back. Once, I set up 5 microphones in the median on a downtown street and recorded 5 discrete audio tracks of traffic going by all around me. Then I encoded that audio to Dolby Digital and listened on my home theater system just to prove that it was possible. But that was as far as I went with that experiment. Your stories of working with 5.1 audio have inspired me to at least consider trying more experiments of my own. I have enough microphones and a multi-channel recorder after all. And yes, I understand that the elements of a 5.1 audio mix aren't always recorded with 5 or more microphones at once. Finally, you've inspired me to look into Reaper. I'm a little embarrassed to admit that I was still using a very old version of Adobe Audition. But hey, it did what I needed on an old Windows computer. Long story, but let's just say that for the last couple of years, I didn't need a lot of complicated audio help, and the audio tools that I already had in my video software were enough to get the job done. But I want to have extra audio capabilities whenever needed anyway, and I really need to consolidate all of my media work onto one computer, and in this case, it's going to be a Mac. I've not had much time to learn Reaper yet, and it's a bit daunting so far because it's very different from my version of Audition. I will stick with it and look for your Reaper podcast in the archives.
Oh, I need to jump in here. I stopped that podcast when I realized I didn't know enough about Reaper to really teach other people about it. And I'm not sure if those episodes are still available, Greg. If they're not, drop me an email, and what I'll do is I'll dig out the MP3 files, because I do back up all of the podcasts that I create, and I can chuck them on a Google Drive folder and share them with you or something like that. We'll work out something if you still want to hear that stuff. What I would recommend highly is spend the, I think it's about $20 American on Groove3.com. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Groove3. It's a little bit like a Lynda.com clone, but they only do audio software video training. And there's a guy on there called Kenny Joya, who's a recording and mixing engineer in the US. And Kenny's a diehard Reaper fan, and he's been recording video training for Reaper for years. And he's got a training title up there. I assume he's working on a version 5, because Reaper version 5 has just shipped. I bought his video training for Reaper version 4, and to be honest, the changes between 4 and 5 are not that extreme. So if you are interested, I would highly recommend going and buying Kenny Joya's Reaper 4 Explained training title. From memory, it's about 18 or 19 movies, and each one's anything from sort of 5 minutes to maybe 15 minutes at a guess. They were really good video training titles. I find his delivery a little slow at times. I think that's just because he wants to make sure that you've got the concept, and I know I'm guilty of that at times, but it is really good training. They had a special on at one point where you could get his Reaper version 4 Explained, Reaper version 4 Advanced Techniques, and he also had one for SWS Extensions, which if you're new to Reaper, you probably haven't even delved into SWS Extensions yet, and that's fine. You probably don't need to worry about them just yet. But long story short, SWS Extensions is made by a third party, and it's some plugins, not in the like VST sense, but it's like a code plugin that can run inside Reaper, and it allows you to write macros and do all sorts of custom funky stuff that Reaper doesn't do natively. So yeah, so I ended up getting all three of these video training titles from Groove3, all done by Kenny, and I got the whole lot for about $40. It was, I felt it was a good deal, and you know, probably a couple of hours of video training. So that helped me a lot, and it really validated my decision to kill off the Don't Fear the Reaper podcast, because I realized how much there was I didn't understand at the time. But you know, the good thing is that, you know, working on this project of Chad's, having watched Kenny's stuff, I now feel like I have a much better understanding of Reaper than I did when I tried that podcast out. Whether or not that means I will start a new one, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I'm not promising anything. I seem to have my finger in too many other pies right now to entertain the idea of a third podcast. So anyway, okay, so just to wrap up Greg's email.
I will stick with it and look for your Reaper podcast in the archives. I promise I will not fear the Reaper. I'm taking advantage of their offer to try it for free for a couple of months, and perhaps I'll be much more confident when it's time to buy a license. Anyway, just wanted to let you know I'm still listening, even if I don't offer a lot of feedback lately. Regards, Greg Anderson, Huntsville, Utah.
Well, thanks, Greg. I really appreciate the email. As for the license, now would be a great time to buy, simply because version 5 has just shipped, which means that you're, what is it? I think it's $60 US. That will give you every iteration of Reaper up to 6.99. And believe me, they do point dot dot releases all the way. So, you know, you're looking at a 200 dot releases between now, well, not quite, because I think we're at 5.03 now, so 197 dot releases from now through till 6.99. And then when 7 ships, whatever the license fee becomes when, you know, Reaper 7 ships, that license would then cover you through to 8.99. I do love their licensing model. I think it's very fair. I think it's very realistic. You know, it's priced so reasonably, I think it has to dissuade, I would hope, any piracy, you know, because you go, well, you know, here's a really excellent platform that does everything, and it's priced at a 100th of what you get charged for, you know, some of the other systems around there. So I think, you know, it's a great model, and I take my hat off to the guys at Reaper. So anyway. All right, look, I'm already a long way into this podcast, and I haven't got to, do I hold this over? Yeah, I am. I'm gonna let this go. The compression discussion that I wanted to have, I'm gonna let that go. I'll get it out in the next episode, pending manageable quantities of emails to address. But I did want to address those couple of emails from Rob and from Greg, simply because, you know, clearly there was interest there in what I'm doing. So thank you guys, I appreciate that. Any more questions, please drop me an email, studio@audio2.com. And until I speak with you again, take care.
Sign language.
Another audio2u.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com
or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email studio@audio2u.com.